Yes, people, this is it. It's Tube Talk on WRCA. Thanks for tuning in tonight, gang.
Have you seen the well-to-do upon Lenox Avenue? On that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air. High hats and colored collars, white spats and $15. Spending every dime for a wonderful time. If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where Harlem Blitz? Putting on the Ritz. Spangled gowns upon the bevy of high browns from down the levee, all misfits. Putting on the Ritz. That's where each and every Lulu Belle goes. Every Thursday evening with her swell bows. Rubbing elbows, come with me and we'll attend their jubilee and see them spend their last 2 bits putting on the Ritz.
Boys, look at that man putting on that Ritz. You look at him, I can.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where Harlem Blitz? Putting on the Ritz. Spangled gowns upon the bevy of high browns from down the levee, all misfits. Putting on that certain Ritz. That's where each and every Lulu Belle goes. Every Thursday evening with her swell bows. Rubbing elbows, come with me and we'll attend their jubilee and see them spend their last 2 bits putting on the Ritz. Come with me and we'll attend their jubilee and see them spend their last 2 bits putting on the Ritz.
Fred Astaire, Putting on the Ritz, Irving Berlin song from 1930. It's all great music, and it's all right here for you on Tube Talk. So we're going to come back and revisit 1930, so you just hold that thought in the back of your head. Thanks for tuning in, gang. And now for the news. Well, we have some news items here we're going to pass along for you. Some things have come to our attention. We've been asked to mention some things. John Coomer has issued a press release indicating that Antique Radio Classified is resuming publication with the February 2014 edition. So I know many folks do subscribe to this. This is from a news release he issued, Dateline, Port Washington, New York, January 10th, 2014. Antique Radio Classified magazine announced today it will resume monthly publication with the February 2014 issue. The antique radio community, as well as the magazine publishing market, is changing, said ARC publisher John Coomer, and we are changing what we do and how we do it in order to continue to provide the number one magazine in the world for collectors of antique vintage radios and electronic equipment. Effective with the February 2014 issue, ARC will continue to be published every month on our website. However, the print version of the magazine will become a quarterly publication. Every 3 months, the previous three web issues will be combined into a single print edition and will be mailed with all relevant articles, advertisements, etc. Our friends in California at the California Historical Radio Society are still seeking support and donations for their new locale in Alameda. Please go to californiahistoricalradio.com for more updates. They are making great progress. These folks are sincere in their love for all things radio. If you or your radio club, now this is an interesting perspective, perhaps you can bring this to the attention of the other people in your club. If your club is also in a position to help, please let them know. You can get in touch with them through their website. They're trying to get out of KRE, which unfortunately has not worked out for them, a station they were trying to restore. They're trying to move into their new locale in Alameda, California, and they ask for your help. There's some interesting videos that they've posted, too, with updates and what's going on. So check it out, if nothing else. It's very fascinating how they're trying to keep this all alive out in the Bay Area. And, you know, it's been a tough winter. Here is a sure sign of spring. Kutztown is coming. The Kutztown Antique Radio Meet, sponsored by the Delaware Valley Historic Radio Club, is coming. May 9th and 10th. It's coming, and spring is coming, folks. It can't come soon enough. Check out the Delaware Valley Historical Radio Club website for more details. www.dvhrc.info. It's at Renatures down in Kutztown. Everyone has a great time. No one goes home unhappy. Check it out. And ladies and gentlemen, is Frank Sinatra. See, I got one right. Finally.
It happened in Monterey a long time ago. I met her in Monterey, in old Mexico. Stars and steel guitars and luscious lips as red as wine broke somebody's heart, and I'm afraid that it was mine. It happened in Monterey without thinking twice. I left her and threw away the key to paradise. My indiscreet heart longs for the sweetheart that I left in old Monterey. Ah, it happened in Monterey a long time ago. I met her in Monterey, in old Mexico. Stars, guitar, lips red as wine broke somebody's heart, and I fear that it was mine. It happened in Monterey, and without thinking twice, I left her and I threw away the key to paradise. My indiscreet heart, how it longs for that sweetheart that I left in old Monterey.
Yes, it happened in old Monterey with Mr. Frank Sinatra. Thank you, Frank, for that lovely rendition. And as they used to say, you know, Jim McKay with the Olympics when I was a kid, covering the globe to bring you the finest. Well, you know, as Tube Talk covers the musical universe to try to bring you the finest in music, this is something we don't always hear a little of, because, you know, the 50s, we start to turn the corner and we're getting away from the big bands and we're starting to get away from some of our old favorites. But the music was still pretty good. And it was still coming through that old vacuum tube set. So we're going to shift gears here a little bit. And here is Elvis.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. can't stop thinking of me. Don't make me feel this way. Come on over here and love me. You know what I want you to say. Don't be cruel to who a heart is true. Why should we be apart? I really love you, baby. Cross my heart. Let's walk up to the preacher and let's say I do. Then you'll know you'll have me, and I know that I'll have you. Don't be cruel to who a heart is true. I don't want no other love. Oh, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't be cruel to who a heart is true. Don't be cruel to who a heart is true. I don't want no other love. Oh, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of.
And that's Mr. Elvis Presley from 1956. Don't be cruel. Don't be cruel to me. Don't be cruel to your radio daddy, folks. Anyway, you know, another reason that I play that for you is I think about that. And in many ways, that's a very sparse song. You know, there's some backing vocals, a drum, a brush, a little guitar riff here and there, and a voice. And, you know, it just goes to show you that even Elvis, just out of the gate, could put more together and have a little melody and a cute song and a nice sentiment, and it didn't need to be overly digitized, compressed, multi-tracked, electronicized, etc., etc., etc. The guy could still sing a song. Well, before we go down to our radio parlor for our guest who's anxiously awaiting us tonight, maybe we can sneak in one more song and a commercial.
Men. Nothing takes it off like Noxzema medicated shave. Take it off. Take it all off. Nothing takes it off like Noxzema medicated shave.
How close you shave, the more you need Noxzema. Noxzema medicated comfort shave.
I don't know what it is. I'm just really drawn to that for some reason, and you know, maybe we'll have to have a separate program just to analyze that.
Thank you.
Glenn Miller with I Got Rhythm off a Bluebird disc. And now on to our guest for this evening. Andrew Ohms joins us in the radio parlor this week. He is a prolific writer with articles featured in many radio club newsletters, as well as the Antique Wireless Association's Gateway. And we're going to discuss an issue tonight that seems so obvious, it gets overlooked at times. And we're going to chat a little bit about listening to your antique set. So, you know, a talented technician or yourself has spent hours, maybe days, months, restoring that great vacuum tube set. So now what do we do with it, Andy? We listen, right?
That's right. That's what it was for originally.
Thanks for coming on tonight. I appreciate it. So, you know, I was reading your article here, Enjoying Antique Radios, and, you know, I liked your analogy here that the set itself is the hardware and the content is really a software, so to speak.
That's right, yes. And a lot of collectors like the set themselves, and they like to make sure it's operational, but they don't really appreciate, you know, how good their sound is or
yeah,
can be.
Yeah, and, you know, I find a lot of people, you know, who I know, who for them the real kick is doing the restoration work, and sometimes I think the set itself gets put a little bit by the wayside. So, you know, we listen to radio, and oftentimes I think we're jaded, as you said in your story. We take it for granted. We don't think about all the radio waves that surround us every day and, you know, how fascinating it must have been, you know, to capture those. And, you know, they're all around us. And as they used to say back in the 20s, I mean, it just came out of the ether. And, you know, so when did radio waves really start to get commercially listened to, I guess, would be a question.
In the early 20s, 20, 21, 22, they didn't carry commercials. The first broadcast didn't. They were election results and maybe some music and so on. Commercials were thought to be, well, inappropriate. But
I think sometimes they still are.
Yes, they definitely are. But in about 2 years or so, they took off. And, you know, I think it was, in a sense, it's a good thing. We have commercials and they drive us crazy and there's too many and all that. But the alternative could be government-controlled radio, which some countries have, and that doesn't lead to the most interesting of listening. Or, like I believe in last I heard in Great Britain, you pay a monthly or an annual license for a radio, and they did that to support the BBC.
Yeah,
we don't have either of those. So,
and from what I understand, interestingly enough, you know, sort of radio drama never went away in England, and I believe there are still some programs that air over there that are serial-type programs and drama-type programs and mystery-type programs. So it's, you know, kind of an interesting dynamic. They have it on the other side of the pond, so to speak, but, you know, that's something that's pretty much dried up for us here.
There are some there, I think, but where it really lasted was in South Africa, where 30, 40 years after our so-called golden age of radio was gone, South Africa continued radio programming because they really limited TV broadcasting because of the world's anger against apartheid.
That's interesting. So, that's an interesting.
Yeah, so that kept radio drama alive.
Well, you know, I mean, there might be some stuff that if you could get your hands on some of it, that would be good stuff to listen to on your antique set. So that would be something we'd have to look into. Maybe we can get a hold of somebody at the South African Radio Club, and we could have a chat about that. So, you know, so the 20s things start to become a little popular, and, you know, radio is still kind of a hobby. You know, it's one of those things that it might not have mass appreciation, but then, as we've been talking with one of our previous guests, we talk a little bit about Edwin Armstrong and the advent of Super Heterodyne, and, you know, boom, in 1930, here we go, and radio becomes something that everybody wants in their home, and it really starts to take off, and people really start to listen. So it's sort of the heyday many people would consider for the sets and for the programming itself. What's your opinion on that?
I think the mid-30s could have been the peak, or maybe the late 30s, early 40s. Television didn't begin to diminish the appeal of radio until 47, 48, when there became enough stations in enough large cities to grab the attention of the average American. Until then, radio was really was it. You know, people in the work every day thinking about what they're going to listen to that night and what they listened to the night before, I think, if they were like me.
Yeah, well, no, it was a big part of people's lives. And, you know, as you mentioned, I like you have an interesting way of phrasing it here in your story, you know, perceived as an old-school, low-tech means of communication in this age of satellites and the Internet. Radio waves are not only necessary for satellite transmissions, internet accessibility, and cell phone usage, but in earlier formats, it is still very much alive in that several thousand, and not, you know, not hundreds, several thousand AM stations and even more FM stations broadcasting daily in the United States and Canada alone. Virtually no country is entirely without an AM or FM station and shortwave program. Reaches every part of the earth. And, you know, I think that's something that we often overlook, that, that radio still connects such a big part of the globe.
Yes. It's outlasted some other old tech technologies like, outlasted the telegraph and definitely the 78 record and the vinyl record.
Don't tell that to some of my friends, okay?
Well, vinyl's coming back, we know.
Vinyl is back, and I have a lot of pals who like to restore the old phonographs. But, you know, it's an interesting thing because you'll see these, you know, especially they're sponsored by software companies. You see these ads on TV where they show people in remote parts of the world, usually, you know, India or China, and they show people, you know, on computers. And granted, the computer is big and it's in many, many places. But in some parts of the world, due to lack of internet access or just due to inability to afford or to get a computer, shortwave is, I know, still very big in parts of Asia and extremely big in Africa. And in many parts of India, it's still what people listen to. And I know the BBC still broadcasts out over the air to many parts of the world. And, you know, while we like to think everybody goes home and checks their emails, they really don't, I guess.
No, and another reason that it's popular, or at least ubiquitous, is low power usage. To get a computer and all of its accessories, you know, printers, et cetera, you need a little more power. A radio, certainly some relatively cheap batteries, but in villages that don't even have that monetary resource, solar-powered.
Yes, yes. Sea Crane had solar-powered, or the Bayless, the wireless crank-type radio,
yeah,
with the Bayless system. And again, I think that was a funny. South Africa comes up twice on the show tonight. I think
I think it did come up.
Gentleman who was from South Africa. And you know, you're right. I mean, you just have to look back at some of the old farm radio sets that, you know, were popular in the U.S. before rural electrification. You know, we had the battery sets that came out even in the 40s with the 1 volt one volt tubes and, you know, relatively modest battery usage. And yes, in some parts of the world, electricity is still, you know, a valuable commodity. So it's something that still works for so many people. And, you know, you talk a little bit about a beginner in the hobby trying to figure out, well, what can I do with this neat piece of antique electronic technology? And you talk about, you know, don't delay your enjoyment. You know, right now you can start experimenting with your set and start listening for some of these big legacy stations. And I know DX is still very popular. Our friends down at the New Jersey Antique Radio Club actually have a DX contest that they get quite a few people to participate in. And, you know, the guys have a blast really just trying to see what they can pick up, you know, here on the East Coast. And what would you recommend somebody who's looking to capture some big legacy stations? What could they check out? What would be worthy tries for a beginner?
Well, New York has two or three, WABC, WFAN, WCBS, of course. WBZ Boston is
one of our biggies.
Yes, the only one I know of north of New York, but there could be others.
No, I think you're probably right on that. I don't think we have one up in Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire.
There might be one in Hartford, WTIC.
Yes, Hartford, Connecticut, yep.
And then, of course, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, WBAL, Baltimore. Well, that's maybe not quite as well known. Washington, D.C., surprisingly, not so many anymore. And then Chicago has got a nest of them. And that, they were well situated for that. You know, they could cover, at the time, the airwaves were, at the time that they started in the 20s, the airwaves were relatively free of too many of interference from other stations, and so they Chicago could pretty much cover almost to the west coast and halfway to the east coast. And of course the legacy stations overlapped. If you lived in Ohio, you could listen to, even if you lived in Michigan, you could listen to New York, you could listen to Boston, you could listen to Chicago, you could listen to Des Moines, Albuquerque, Denver.
Sure.
All from one location, not always the equal with equal quality, and not always at the same time of the evening, but you could listen to them.
Yeah, and you know the other thing that I strikes me a little bit that I think you know the casual radio enthusiast might not be aware of. You start to look at some of these old Sears catalogs and some of these older magazines, and you'll see that radio sets, even you know fairly simple broadcast band sets, would be advertised. And well, here's a picture of a map, you know, with maybe 10 principal yeah. cities up in the greater Boston area that people would listen to. So it wasn't really sold for somebody to listen to just the Boston stations. They're talking about Hartford. They're talking about New York, maybe Cleveland, Cincinnati. It was an interesting way to you know, the country and the world were really being marketed to people. It wasn't just that people would be listening to locals.
Right. A lot of our stations now, if not definitely majority of our stations now, are 24/7. Back then, many, even the large ones, would sign off at 10, 11, midnight, maybe 1 a.m., and very few broadcast all night. And then certain cities, for example, Chicago, I believe all the stations cut off Monday night and did not broadcast until Tuesday morning sign-on time. And that was so that local hobbyists would have the airwaves clear to try to catch Albuquerque and Denver and Fort Worth.
Well, that's fascinating. And you know, what a thrill it is for somebody who's, you know, maybe especially if it's during the 30s or the 40s, times might be a little tough for you. You might have a limited budget. The likelihood of a big train trip, you know, before the advent of, you know, relatively inexpensive air travel. I mean, you might not be able to afford a large motor trip or train trip. And here I can sit in, you know, the middle of the country and pick up something out, you know, in Los Angeles. What a thrill that must have been for people.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, plane travel was unheard of. Train travel was expensive, and who had time? Everybody was working, you know.
Sure.
And
yeah.
yet at night you could travel around the globe if you had the right equipment.
And it still is fun. I mean, I can remember when I was a kid, and this would be, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, you know, I'd keep a list, you know, what did I pick up, and,
yeah.
you know, certain, depending on how propagation was, you know, you might go through a period when you do better than others, and, you know, you have to find different things that you would enjoy listening to. And while there was a certain amount of networking, you know, programming, I mean, the big networks had great programs and a lot of good old-time radio shows, there was still some local stuff that you could pick up, and things must have really had a good local flavor, so you could get an idea and appreciation a little bit about, you know, the different aspect of the American culture, you know, that you could
yes.
get right sitting in your living room or your radio room there.
Definitely. Old-time radio is quite a got quite a large number of hobbyists and fans. But what I miss from that is it's all network. And that, you know, that was the famous, the Jack Benny's and the Kirby
sure.
Keys and so on. But there was so much other interesting radio, regional, and especially on the legacy stations, the all-nighters, they had fascinating talk hosts, or they had kind of what I called overnight semi-classical music with a man, usually, with dulcet tones, speaking quietly to those who were still awake during this time of the evening. And a very unusual program. You know, just wasn't a network. It didn't need to be. They covered plenty of square miles without a network.
And there was a certain intimacy, I think, to that. And you hit,
oh,
it, right,
yeah.
you hit it right on the head. Now, I have, it was odd, a woman in our neighborhood passed away. She actually had lived to be 100, believe it or not. And as they were cleaning out her house, she had a lot of things that she had packed away, and you know, there were a lot of old newspapers she had packed them in. So I didn't get any really old newspapers, but I found a few older newspapers. Now, these would be from the late 50s and some from even the 60s. And if you look at the radio listings, I mean, people say, now, well, what do you mean radio listings? You're lucky if your local paper has a few TV listings. But you would look in the radio listings, and there were, you know, in many cases, 15-minute programs. You know, and
oh,
something
yeah.
something would be either be a cooking show, and there might be a local religious program from a significant religious figure in your area. There would be programs on lots of different topics, lots of different hobbies, And, you know, some of them, you know, you look back at it and you say, well, it sounds a little hokey. But you know what? They wouldn't have been on if there weren't people who were interested. And it really had a lot of color. Some of these people weren't really professional broadcasters, probably, you know, much like myself. And but the content must have been very interesting. And, again, I think people felt a very big connection, you know, to these personalities.
Sure. The radio soap operas, and they were networked, but there were over 300 of them. Not all at one time, but NBC and CBS particularly would have 17 or 18 a day, and they were all 15 minutes. But when I was a kid, I lived way out in the prairies of South Dakota, but I looked at the Chicago paper, and WIND Chicago, still a good station, not super powerful, but well-regarded, they had 15-minute music segments listed in the paper. Okay, 9 o'clock, Frank Sinatra, 15 minutes. 9:15, Perry Como, 15 minutes. 9:30, Doris Day, 15 minutes. to cover the whole day.
Well, you know, it's funny because people think that, you know, there was no choice, you know, because now everybody's used to, oh, well, I can download this, that, and I can customize my playlist. But, you know, it was neat to have somebody do it for you, and all you had to do was know, well, you know, I've got some time, and that's my 15-minute segment, or that's my 20-minute segment. So,
yeah.
You know, there was a certain degree of, you know, cafeteria program almost, if you will. We're going to take 1 minute here. We're going to push the pause button and remind everybody that this is Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, 1330 AM. Our guest is Andy Olms. I am Paul Burish. And you have reached the zenith of the independently produced fine broadcast experience. Wonderful music, fascinating talk, and we're chatting a little bit about putting a good old-fashioned antique radio to use tonight. And, you know, one of the things we get into here, you start to talk a little bit about in your story, is the advent of transistors. And, you know, transistors being quote-unquote solid state, and vacuum tubes being quote-unquote hollow state, which was a phrase I hadn't heard used before, so I was kind of taken with that hollow state concept. But you talk about, you know, the vintage radio enthusiasts sometimes will tell you that, well, yes, you get a different sound out of an antique set. It may be a mellower sound, however we, you know, choose to characterize that. Well, they're certainly different, and, you know, they certainly might be a little bit softer. Maybe they're not as sharp and crisp as some of the digital sound. And I think you're very wise, Andy. You say you're not going to get involved in that unwinnable argument as to, you know, which is better, tube or digital. And because, you know, how do you, you know, you said mellow is not a precisely measurable electrical value. So I like the way you dodged the bullet there and having to pick sides. But, you know, what do you hear from folks who still listen to vacuum tube electronics? How do they, you know, what in their mind's eye do they characterize the sound as, or what attracts them to it, I guess, is what I'd say.
Well, they know that a good set, and that would be a well-designed one, with the right components, like the correct number of tubes, et cetera, and a nice speaker. Doesn't need to be giant, but I myself have a 5-inch standard, although there's some good 3 and 4 inchers, mm-hmm. but a good 5-inch speaker and a nice cabinet, and the acoustics of the cabinet. Again, that's not an electronic issue, that's a sound architecture issue, but a good old 1930s, 1940s wood cabinet, console, some big table models, and some plastic cabinets, too, with the right buffering inside and so on, really put out a nice sound that did not leave anyone wishing for a better sound. Interestingly, entertainment sound has followed some interesting trails. It started off, you could only listen through earphones, and, of course, audio quality wasn't nearly as important as it became later. And then when radios with speakers came out, then they were interested. People were interested, what station could you get, how interesting is the music and the talk, but not the fidelity. And then gradually fidelity got more important.
Mm-hmm.
And by the late 40s and the 50s, fidelity was a super big issue. And there are all kinds of extremely high-priced equipment with extremely interesting complex circuits to produce fidelity. But now we have both. We have entertainment surround sets with our giant TVs, and they put out theater-type quality booming throughout your living room, and yet the majority of listening, I think, is done by people, not all young people, but by people on their smartphones with tiny little speakers and so on. And yet, I must admit that the quality of really small devices now, the sound quality can be quite good.
There
but it doesn't have a resonance that some of those old radios did.
Yeah, that perhaps might be the word. And I think you're probably right on the cabinet as well. I mean, I have some... nothing particularly rare or overly sophisticated, but I have a couple of RCA sets, 5-inch speaker, but a nice wood cabinet. And, you know, if you put the volume up a bit, because it seems as if some of these older sets take the volume better than a Walmart or a Kmart plastic AM/FM radio that you might get that's almost, you know, in the disposable end of things. But you do get a certain unique sound, and in some cases I'll pick things up, or it seems as if there's pretty good separation too, as far as, you know, I'll hear sounds that I might not have heard when if I play something on my stereo, or if I play something that I have even that's old that's on vinyl. It's hard to characterize, and they all have sort of their unique characteristics to them. And I think that's probably something else that the hobbyist enjoys, is, you know, not everything is really the same. They all have their own personalities.
Right. And so in spite of saying, well, the cabinet's very important for the resonance and so on, as a listener, I was interested in content and not in fidelity, and there's nothing I like better when I got a new radio or a different radio than to take it out of the cabinet and set it on the shelf in my bedroom. And so I'd lay it at night, I could see those glowing tubes.
Oh, yes, yes. You know, and there are some people who'll tell you, you know, a nice, well-ventilated set, too. They might tell you that they think it would last longer. I don't know about that. And, you know, that's another interesting topic you get to when you're talking about listening and using your antique radios. You talk to some people, and they'll say, well, you know what, these things, 60, 70, 75 years old, you shouldn't play it all the time. You know, maybe an hour or two here and there. And then you have other folks who say, well, look, if it's well restored and you went through every capacitor and you checked all those resistors and got every bit of rotted wiring out of there and you really did your job, you know, you should be able to come home and listen to that just like somebody would have listened to it when it was brand new out of the box. Do you find people who want to try to treat these more gingerly, or do you find some people who just say, hey, you know what, I did the work on this thing and I'm going to play it until it blows out and I'll have to fix it again?
Well, sure. When you get a new radio, a collector or an electronics enthusiast knows better than to a new old radio. You know better than to plug it in.
Yes.
You need to
first
check the circuits, check the resistors, the capacitors, and then ideally you plug it in at about 20 volts, and just park it there for 20 minutes, and if no smoke comes out or no
kind of bring it up a little bit, yep.
Yeah, bring it up, and eventually you get there. But once it's going, I will say transistors, I think, are more reliable than vacuum tubes. First off, they're much less complex and therefore fewer critical parts. But radios didn't wear out just from being on. I think more likely a tube would blow off and on by turning the switch off and on. So once it's on for 20 minutes, you may as well leave it on for 20 hours.
Right, right. It was probably power surging coming up, or if it was, you know, some problem with the filtering, you know, might hurt your tubes, and the audio output tubes and the rectifiers probably go first
in the
AC/DC sets.
Some of the circuits use the dial light to, control some of the internal voltages, and of course if the dial light blew and either you had nothing, or you had tubes that were vulnerable.
Yeah, it was a symptom that, you know, there was something else that was more wrong in the set. Now, you know, there's another interesting feature here that, you know, sometimes, especially look at simpler sets that are just broadcast band only, and you'll see the frequencies expressed in kilocycles, but then you also see the wavelengths underneath them. You know, the split dial. It might show you the meters of the signal, as well as, you know, what we would consider a station or a channel to tune into. So I just found that kind of interesting that people, you know, in those days would even want to know how that's expressed. What do you think there was any logic behind showing that on the dial for folks?
Well, the first commercial, the first sets that carried programming for the public probably didn't even show kilohertz or kilocycles. It just showed wavelength. And in fact, one of the intriguing aspects of early radio history is that the FCC or the forerunner government agency that controlled broadcasting originally said there was only two frequencies, two spots on the dial that broadcast could be used for broadcasters. And one was for information, and the other was for entertainment. And, of course, if you're in Chicago and there's 10 stations all broadcasting entertainment at the same time, that didn't work very well. So it didn't take long before they allowed the dial to be spread out in a number of stages. The last stage was about 15 years ago. The kilohertz moved from 1600 to 1700 that were available.
Yep.
But the early sets would just show a wavelength, and because that was the only number, the only measurement that was utilized.
I see.
But it didn't take long. I'm guessing here that by the late 20s, kilocycles came in, because maybe it was, I don't know why, it was easier for the stations to announce their location.
No, I'd say you're on track there, because, you know, from a commercial point of view, it might be hard to say, you know, we're at XYZ number of meters, but
yeah,
to say this is 850 on your, you know, broadcasting at, it is easier to kind of make that connection with your audience and do your get your identity going and, you know, click with the advertisers as well. You know, we're always on this station. So, you know, there's still a lot out there to listen to. There's a lot of interesting broadband programming. There's still some that's local. And as AM, you know, changes, you'll find independent shows sometimes like this, or you'll find lower power stations with interesting ethnic programs or programs with niche appeal. So it's, if you have a good set, if it's a sensitive set, there's a lot to listen to. And even though shortwave has changed so dramatically, there's still a lot of folks who enjoy seeing what's out there. I mean, I hear from people who still find it a thrill to pick up stuff that skipped, you know, halfway across the globe. Regardless of what the content is, it's almost for the challenge of doing it.
Right. There's both content and geography. Both of them make it interesting.
And, you know, it's funny because we received not too long ago here at the station, a report came in, and it's interesting how people, you know, ask for a QSL these days. Mm-hmm. This was from a fellow in Sweden who had picked up WRCA over the air with a beverage antenna and a communications receiver. And, you know, he makes a little recording and he shoots a little email to the station with a MP3 format recording. So sort of that serves as his verification that he heard the station. And then he asks, you know, could you drop me a line or an email or just something to confirm? But, you know, and it's, you know, it's not just a purely American or hobbyist phenomenon. It's really a very worldwide phenomenon, especially popular with people who are, you know, interested in engineering or electronics design or the history of electronics. There's still an awful lot of us out there. So we'd just like to say thanks, Andy, for coming on and giving us your unique perspective and sharing some of your ideas on how we can put that good antique radio set to use. We shouldn't let them just sit there on the shelf. So
thanks. Thanks for letting me have this little chat with you.
We appreciate it. You take care now. Have a great night.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
That's the theme from The Human Jungle, a British television series from the 60s. Very foreboding sounding, but very 60s as well. We'd love to thank Andy Olms for sharing his unique perspective on how to put your antique radio to good use. Thanks, Andy, for joining us. He comes to us all the way from California just to be here on Tube Talk.
My baloney has a first name. It's O-S-C-A-R. My baloney has a second name. It's M-A-Y-E-R. Oh, I love to eat it every day. And if you ask me, I'll say, 'cause Oscar Mayer has a way with C-O-L-O-D-N-A.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for choosing to spend an hour of your time, valuable time, with us tonight here on Tube Talk. You have truly reached the zenith of the fine, independently produced broadcast band experience. You can always pick us up over the air at 1330 AM or streaming on the WRCA website. We do this here for you and for duty and humanity. Now, I told you to kind of bookmark 1930 there in your brain with our wonderful Fred Astaire song. Anyway, for a little radio perspective back to 1930 and tie it in a little bit with our discussion with Andy. In August 1930, Philco introduces the Model 20, the Baby Grand. It would propel Philco to the number one manufacturer spot in radio. Those facts are courtesy, by the way, folks, of philcoradio.com. Just a little pop culture from 1930. 1930, 3M employee Richard Drew invents Scotch brand cellulose tape in 1930. Imagine that. The Mickey Mouse comic strip debuts in the January 13th, 1930 edition of the New York Mirror. On October 17th, 1931, well, I'm out of 1930 already, Al Capone was convicted of income tax evasion. And here we go. 1932, Democrat Franklin Roosevelt defeats Herbert Hoover in the 1932 election. Boulder Dam is completed 2 years ahead of schedule and under budget in 1936. Olympic time, Jesse Owens wins 4 gold medals during the 1936 Summer Olympics. Ty Cobb, Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson, Babe Ruth, and Honus Wagner become the first inductees into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 1936. A big radio moment. The German airship Hindenburg is destroyed while attempting to land at the Lakehurst Naval Air Station on May 6, 1937. American aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart disappears mysteriously over the Pacific Ocean while attempting to circumnavigate the globe, July 2, 1937. Superman debuts in Action Comics No. 1 in June of 1938. Gone with the Wind wins the Academy Award for the Best Motion Picture in 1939. There you have it, the Fabulous 30s, brought to you here on Tube Talk.